Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Robert Ellis. This is the third interview that Robert has given to the Middle Way podcast. The first one he did on critical thinking, and then in the second one he gave a member profile talking a bit about his life and how he basically came up with the idea of Middle Way philosophy. In this one, well, he's been looking into cognitive biases for his latest book, The Integration of Belief, which is part of the Middle Way philosophy series. And so that's what he's going to be talking about today. Well, hello, Robert. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you, Barry. Hello.
Okay, so what are cognitive biases?
Well, broadly, they're tendencies to misjudge what's going on as far as we can relate to it. So they're ways in which we make mistakes in our grasp of conditions. You know, we don't engage with conditions in some way because there's some kind of blockage. There's something stopping us from doing so. Perhaps the most common and well-known example of a cognitive bias is confirmation bias, for example. So where we have a tendency to look for something that fits the theory that we already have. Yeah, and that's obviously an example of a way in which we have a disposition which interferes with our grasp of what's going on, because we'll miss things that don't fit into the theory that we're looking for evidence for.
Okay, and why do we have these? Why have we got the confirmation bias? Why is it in our makeup?
Well, there are explanations which psychology provides, and for example, there are lots of evolutionary explanations. Though I haven't particularly been going down that route, but you can read up about evolutionary explanations as to why we have ended up with these biases as adaptations in the early history of humankind. But another kind of answer to why we have cognitive biases, I think, is closely related to brain lateralization. So that the fact that we have two hemispheres of the brain, and the way that Ian McGilchrist has written about, and that the left hemisphere tends to create representations of things which it then gets very attached to. So it's the left hemisphere that creates our representations of our goals and the concepts with which we build up those ideas of what we want and what we want to achieve. So because the left hemisphere has a tendency to hang on to these, they tend to get in the way of the information which the right hemisphere tends to, when it's working properly, when the hemispheres are working together properly, the right hemisphere gets new information relatively easily from the world around us. But if the left hemisphere gets too hooked on its own account of what's going on its own representation, then in some ways it blocks the information coming in via the right. So that, I think, that's another sort of basic kind of explanation you can give for why we have cognitive biases, because our two hemispheres, which normally work well together or ought to be able to work well together, sometimes don't do so. And that's what creates the whole relationship that I've been investigating between cognitive biases and metaphysics and dogmatic sorts of states and approaches in our lives.
Okay. What are fallacies or logical fallacies?
Well, logical fallacies are mistakes in logic, basically, which go back to Aristotle, at least in the Western tradition. They're also identified in Indian logical tradition. So They're another kind of account of mistakes that we make. The way that these have often been seen is as mistakes in reasoning, so mistakes in the way in which we draw conclusions from our assumptions or premises. So we start off with certain assumptions and we draw conclusions from those assumptions. And sometimes we don't get this right. We make mistakes in the way that we do so. So that's the way that fallacies have been traditionally understood, primarily. But I've been very struck by researching this area, by the fact that fallacies don't necessarily have to be seen in these terms, that they're not, although you can analyze them in terms of logic and faults of logic, anything that you can analyze in white, or you can also alternatively understand just as a blockage in our way of understanding the world, as a set of false assumptions. So that's the kind of new thing that I'm going to be trying to say in this book that I've been working on, the Middle Way Philosophy for Integration of Belief, that although I'm not saying that logic is dead or there's no such thing as logic and rationality, but that it's not actually the main point. It's not actually the important point of assessment for us. It's not the main way in which you get things right or wrong. It's the crucial point really is what assumptions we make, and the assumptions we make can either block new information coming into us or allow it. If they're more helpful assumptions, they can allow that information to come through to us, so we can address conditions better by being more aware, in other words, of what's going on, or less aware.
Are you saying then that both cognitive biases and fallacies are unjustified assumptions, in a sense?
Yes. So there've been different traditions of ways in which these things have become understood. So basically, fallacies have been identified by philosophers going back to Aristotle, and cognitive biases have arisen much more recently. They've been identified by psychologists and checked out experimentally by seeing whether in experimental conditions people do regularly make these sorts of mistakes.
Yeah.
But they're just different. As far as I can see, they're different ways of approaching the same thing. So, cognitive biases are fallacies as discovered by psychologists, and fallacies are cognitive biases as discovered by philosophers. Depends very much on the context or the tradition in which they've been understood, more than anything.
And do psychologists see cognitive bias as emotion interfering with cognition, and philosophers see logic interfering with emotion? Is there a disconnect there between emotion and cognition in a way?
Yeah, that's another thing that I want to challenge, really, that assumption that there's such a thing as sort of pure cognition or pure rationality, which emotions then interfere with. But I think it's in fact there were the helpful and less helpful emotions, just as there were helpful and less helpful cognitions, and the two are always interrelated. You never get one purely without the other, just as you don't get facts without values or values without facts. That's part of the restriction with which particularly philosophers have looked at it, I think, because when they've been looking at logic, they've been much less concerned with the emotional states which lead us to make logical errors as they see them. You can see those errors obviously in terms of logic, or you can see them in terms of the whole of our brains and bodies and the way in which they're involved in making those kinds of mistakes. Yeah. And that's much more informative, I think.
Okay, so could you give us some examples?
Okay, well, what I've been setting out to do in this book that I've been working on is to sort of classify cognitive biases in relation to fallacies and in relation to metaphysical types of metaphysical belief. There's a great range of different possible cognitive biases I could talk about that, you know, fit into this kind of classification. But perhaps I could just pick out a few examples. I mean, I've already mentioned confirmation bias, which I say is something that you find basically in all of the cognitive biases to some extent, that there's a fixed idea there of something that we expect to be the case, and we tend to project that onto what we actually experience. Another important example, I think, is in-group bias. So the tendency we have to go along with what the group tells us, and to judge things in terms of the group, and to judge the characteristics of people outside the group that we happen to belong to more harshly than those inside the group. So there's kind of default there, which will make us, particularly for some kind of ambiguity, or it's not very clear what somebody is like who's a bit different from us, we're more likely to make worse assumptions about them just because they're a bit strange. Racial stereotyping is a very obvious example that people are much more likely to jump to worse conclusions about somebody who's a different race from themselves, for example.
Okay.
Perhaps to jump to something quite different, there are various cognitive biases which are quite basic, which I think are quite closely related to our attitudes to meaning and the ways in which we understand meaning. And one of those is anchoring. So anchoring is the tendency we have when we make a new judgment for that to be sort of tied to or anchored to the way in which we've been thinking at that point, up to that point. So
supermarkets use this, presumably.
They do, yes. Have you come across this?
Yeah. Is it that, you know, you were, well, if you go into a shop and they put the prices artificially high so that when something is pitched at mid-range, then you think it's cheap, but you think you can afford it.
Indeed. So that's the skill of the salesman who starts off giving you a default position, which is sort of closer to where he wants you to be. And then although you will, if the salesman starts with a high price, for example, and you're buying, so you want a lower price, you'll beat them down. But actually, you'll start at a higher point in your way of thinking about the whole thing than you would have done if you'd come up with the anchor point yourself. So they've done experiments, like, for example, if you're given people in an experiment a random number and then asking them how many countries there are in Africa, and the way in which they judge, they've got a vague idea of how many countries there are in Africa, so they then make a guess at that, which is always, it's been shown by these experiments that it's always influenced by that number that they've just been given. So if the number is considerably lower than the number of countries in Africa, then it will turn out to be lower than, they will misjudge the number of countries in Africa because of that lower anchor, as it were. And if it's higher, they'll misjudge it the other way. And I think that relates to the whole idea of cognitive models, that we sort of construct an idea of, a coherent, as it were, logical idea of representation of the world that fits together. But sometimes that cognitive model can be inadequate to the circumstances, or it might not be the best one that we should be using in that context, and we have difficulty jumping to a different cognitive model whereby we think of things in a different way from what we started off with. But it's a bit easier if there's a bit of a break. So, when you wake up early in the morning, say, your mind is fresh, or some people's minds are fresh anyway, then, you're not anchored in such a clear way. So you can think more creatively. and you know, you're relatively free of a phenomenon like anchoring, but anchoring is you know, a way that it interferes with our capacity to think in a new way, to engage with new circumstances appropriately.
Is there anything that all these biases have in common? Have you come across anything in your recent research that has been new to you in that regard?
Well, I started off with a rough idea of what I thought they had in common, and then found, I mean, obviously there's danger of confirmation bias here, but I think I found that that I was justified in believing that what cognitive biases have in common is absolutization. And that, again, seems to be something that's not in the treatment that psychologists give them. And obviously that's the way in which I relate them to metaphysical beliefs.
So just to clarify, what is absolutization?
Okay, so it's a tendency to think about whatever it is absolutely, as opposed to incrementally. So it's all or nothing, in other words, that you've got a position which you, well, the test of whether your position is absolute is whether or not you can incrementalize it. If you can turn it into a more or less thing in any respect, then it's not absolute. But if it is, then it is absolute.
Yeah. And why do you think other researchers into cognitive biases have that has passed them by, that potential insight?
Well, I think an assumption which has tended to be made both by philosophers and psychologists is sort of unity of perspective, the unity of the self. So they tend to think in terms of either we are thinking absolutely as a whole, and thus the beliefs that we arrive at will be absolute, or they're not. Yeah. But I'm thinking, my model is much more that we have different things going on at the same time. We have different beliefs and different desires competing with each other, like, you know, trees in a forest. Our minds are forests with all these different trees, as it were, all competing with each other for the sunlight. Some of those trees in our mental forest are absolute ones, and sometimes those become dominant, and those are the ones that interfere with our judgment, I think, and so create cognitive biases at the points where they are dominant. But that's why they have a distorting effect. So you know, if you look at cognitive biases in how they operate, that was the most of the time they just distort our judgment in some way. So they seem to be just an incremental effect on our judgments. But I think that incremental effect is actually due to an absolute judgment or absolute assumption being made by a particular dominating desire or belief. So that's exactly the same account that I arrived at with trying to explain metaphysics and the whole sort of way in which people arrive at sort of dogmatic beliefs, and the way those dogmatic beliefs then have such a negative effect on you know, the way we live our lives and the judgments we make.
Yeah. Okay. How do we then go about recognizing that we've got one of those absolutizing trees in our mental forest?
Well, it's tricky, I think, that's why I think the study of cognitive biases can be helpful to people, that you know, they've gradually come to recognize the fact that they do have these different tendencies. So that's why I think it's so useful to think about cognitive biases rather than just reacting to metaphysical beliefs. You know, so there's you know, common reaction to religious, absolute religious beliefs, for example, and you know, the atheist groups that object to them on the grounds of their absoluteness, basically. But if we can see how that kind of tendency is actually found in a much wider range of our judgments, in almost all our experience involves these kinds of problems, then we should gradually get into a much position to make that understanding much more part of our everyday lives. But I think it's a long process to get to understand this range of cognitive biases. And it probably helped, though, I think, to be able to think of them in clusters and to relate them to each other rather than just having a list. So again, that's been something I've been trying to do. So it's a question of study and practice, and there's a long way to go also, I think, developing forms of practice whereby people can become aware of and work with this wide range of different biases. Obviously, cognitive behavioral therapy does this to some extent from a particular angle, a therapeutic angle, but I think this could be done much more widely by individuals working with their own experience.
Doing meditation and critical thinking, someone?
Indeed, yeah. Critical thinking could have a crucial role here, I think. And that's why, you know, I think the role of critical thinking, it's not so much, as I see it now anyway, about learning how to reason. We all do reason, but it's a question of making the right assumptions or making helpful assumptions when you do reason and avoiding the ones that are going to create a blockage, that are going to distort our judgments.
This goes against somewhat Daniel Kahneman's more pessimistic view that we can't really do much about these cognitive biases in his book Thinking Fast and Slow. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it was a book which inspired me, because I think he goes a long way there to make us aware of cognitive biases. It's become quite a well-known book, which has obviously helped a lot of people to start thinking about them who wouldn't otherwise have done so. So it's great from that point of view. But I think partly he's made some of the assumptions that psychologists tend to make in understanding the full implications of what he's discovered. And one of those, as I mentioned earlier, is the assumption of the self, and that I think not thinking through the full implications of the fact that we do change, we have different beliefs and desires going on, and we switch between them. Some of them may repress others at different times and so on. And I think if you take that into account, actually it gives a lot more grounds for optimism, because there is a lot of our experience which is open. I think, you know, that although these cognitive biases do become dominant at various times, we can also be and are also aware in a more open way at a lot of other times.
So
if we can simply focus our awareness more or increasingly on those more open states, whilst also becoming more critically aware of the effect that these absolutizations are having on us, I think that gives a lot more scope than Kahneman seems to allow for. But obviously he is going on his experience and the various attempts that have been made within psychology or research into how well people have been able to overcome cognitive biases. But those experiments do seem to me to have worked very often on certain assumptions, which I wouldn't always share. For example, we were talking earlier about anchoring.
Yeah.
And so there was a kind of what seems to have been quite a widespread consensus that you can't really do much about anchoring. You know, we're always going to be anchored. and in the sense, as with all cognitive biases, I'd accept that you know, the cognitive bias always does tell us about a certain kind of parameter, a certain set of conditions that limit what we can do. But within that, there is also a zone of responsibility with vague borders. It's not something we can clearly delineate, but nevertheless we experience it. I think that zone of responsibility. So in the case of anchoring, I think more recent research has given more hope that we can work with anchoring. And it helps, for example, if you're trying to think differently from the anchor that you had, the sort of thing that was dominating your mind at the time you're thinking about it, like a price given to you by a salesman or whatever, then obviously you can compensate. You know, you can be aware of the fact, oh, this salesman's given me a very high anchor, so I'm going to actually come in with my own anchor, and yeah, it's going to be much lower than that. And of course, you could overcompensate, so there's also a middle way judgment to be made here, isn't there? There's you've got to, in your response to the cognitive bias and the conditions that alerts us to, we've got to avoid being either positively or negatively absolute, either just assuming we can do nothing about it or assuming that we can just be totally free of it. You know, it will always have that conditioning effect on us. But some recent research I've read on anchoring does seem to suggest, you know, that people can make more progress than was originally thought, particularly once they know which way to adjust. They can adjust away from the anchor that they've been given, and find some sort of balance in their judgment.
Okay. And cognitive biases are, would you say, in effect, a really good example, backed up by a wealth of evidence, that metaphysics creates delusion?
Yes, I think so. And that seems to be a link that's been underappreciated, you know, that this is all about metaphysics. And Daniel Kahneman, for example, in his book, skirts around religion completely. You know, there's no suggestion there that some religious beliefs, or particularly absolute religious beliefs, might involve cognitive biases in extreme forms, in fact. If you just take theism, I mean, theistic belief is a sort of massive confirmation bias, in a sense, isn't it? That somebody who believes that God exists makes that part of their whole way of understanding the world. They will then understand the world in that sense, so it's self-justifying. And it's the inability to see it differently from that that's a major stumbling block for them and creates conflict both within themselves and with others. But exactly the same process can happen for somebody who takes a negative view of that and is, you know, quite definite that there is no God, and therefore will again see the world in those terms and not be able to appreciate the positive things that maybe the theist does appreciate through, you know, having that set of assumptions.
Okay, my final question, Robert. How does this all tie in with the middle way?
Okay, well, I've mentioned the middle way several times already, but it's basically that we have extremes of response to cognitive biases. So cognitive biases make us aware of certain conditions that affect our lives, and we can respond to that with different kinds of metaphysical assumptions, either positive or negative. So the middle way involves finding that ambiguous place, that uncomfortable ambiguous place in between them, and being content with that. Avoiding cognitive biases and working with cognitive biases, and negative or positive responses to them seems to me to be a direct application of them, or direct way of understanding the middle way and working with the middle way.
Okay. Thanks again for a really interesting interview, Robert.
Okay. Thank you, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.